What is the most powerful nature experience you've ever had?
I butchered a caribou at 35 below with Yupik Eskimo wife, Edna. And I remember this moment where she slid open the cavity and the caribou was steaming and the insides were steaming. And my hand was so cold, I could barely hold the knife. It was shaking. And so she took my hands and she guided them into the opening. And when I withdrew them, they were wet with blood, but they were warm again. And I thought, these are my hands, you know. It was a really interesting experience.
Aidan Campbell was just 15 years old when she butchered a caribou at minus 35 degrees. Today she's 17. She's made 3 Alaskan wilderness trips with her father. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. And what is it about wilderness that draws some people back again and again to the places that test the limits of their strength and endurance? James and Aidan Campbell are not your typical father and daughter, and they've been places very few people go.
The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is 20 million acres of raw wilderness. You have the mountains, you have the tundra, you have glacier-fed rivers. It's beautiful, but it's also a very harsh landscape.
How far away were you from other people?
Well, we were about 300 miles northeast of Fairbanks. We were a long, long way away. I think the nearest village is Fort Yukon or Arctic Village, and they were both about 120 miles away. So we were all by our lonesome.
That's a long way to go for groceries.
Yes.
What do you eat?
Well, my favorite is caribou heart, and I think that tastes like the best steak I have ever had. My least favorite was beaver tail, and my dad always says that it tastes like if you fry chicken in a pan. So take that, then take out the chicken, and then that Crisco, eat that. And that's what beaver tail tastes like. Yeah. All the fat and Crisco.
So we want lean meat down here. Up there, particularly in winter, they want meat just loaded with fat. So they shoot the fattest moose, the fattest caribou.
So what is living in those conditions, what does that change about your sense of your own body?
Well, you certainly feel very, very vulnerable. You know that you're at the mercy of Mother Nature. The cold, the river ice, you fall through the river ice, hypothermia, obviously. Just so many things can go wrong up there, which makes you feel very, very human and very expendable.
I'm just thinking, you're her dad. I mean, a parent's job is to keep their kids safe.
Yeah.
Were you crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I was criticized for putting Aidan at risk, but we prepared long and hard for each trip. And yeah, with Aidan, yeah, my burden of responsibility, you can imagine, was enormously high. And that weighed on me psychologically. But the great thing was these trips were kind of rite of passage trips. And in each trip, I saw her become more comfortable, more self-reliant, more composed, and more confident.
And Aidan, I can imagine that, you know, in these kinds of extreme conditions, your dad's, all his protective instincts would come out and he'd want to be really careful about the risks you took. So yeah. Were there times when you would kind of push back and say, you know, no, I got this, or back off?
There were certainly times where I had to take the lead and I was responsible for both of us, particularly on that last trip when we were in the canoe together and I was in the bow of the boat, which meant that I was the captain. I had to pick my line through the rapids and give instructions to my dad. And so initially I didn't know how to respond to that, and I meekly whispered commands to him, and he couldn't hear me over the roar of the river, and both of us were getting mad and we had many near collisions. And so finally I just said, Daddy, you're going to have to trust me. You're just going to have to let me follow my instincts. And he did. And by the time we got to the Arctic Ocean, I was barking commands at my dad and I was the boss of that canoe.
Aidan, what's the worst thing that happened on that trip, or the the riskiest, most dangerous thing?
I would probably say when we turned the canoe, because it was incredibly cold that day. I was suddenly in the boat by myself. My dad had fallen out. I was still in the canoe, so I was trying to get the boat through the rapids. He was trying to get back to me, and I didn't want it to capsize, of course, because then you lose your stuff, possibly the satellite phone. And then once we finally did get my dad back in the boat, he had hypothermia. And so I could see the progression, which was hard for me because I did not know how to help him. I told my dad, I said, we need to stop. We need to make a fire. We need to get you warm. He said, no, let's go a little bit farther. And in a case, I think, of fate and incredible luck, we actually discovered a native hunting cabin on the Arctic coast. And so we took refuge there. And I think that saved his life.
Wow. So I have to say, I really love hearing stories like this. I think lots of people do. I don't want to do that. Do you enjoy it afterwards in the telling, or do you actually enjoy it at the time?
There are periods where I was miserable, but there are also periods where I felt the adventure, and there are moments of wonder and joy. You feel alive when you're in the wilderness. And actually, when I came home, I realized that I was no longer content, because compared to Alaska, my life felt monotonous, and I felt like something was missing.
Aiden tells a funny story about my telling her, well, just enjoy the magnificence of this scenery.
Must be something you heard a bunch.
Yes, when I was in the canoe and I was in the bow of the boat, and I was always had my eyes on the rapids coming ahead and the boulder gardens, and I was trying to plan how we would navigate through. And my dad would be sitting in the back of the boat, and he'd have his paddle up on the gunwales. He'd be looking out over the mountains, and he'd say, Aiden, just soak it up. You are in 20 million acres of raw wilderness. You will never see anything like this in your life. I'd say, yeah, Dad, but, you know, watch the right. We're going to have some rapids coming up. Aiden, just relax for a second. Just give it a break. I want you to look around. So it definitely was a role reversal.
You probably felt like, I'm keeping you alive.
Yeah.
And she was.
James and Aiden Campbell. You can read about their adventures in James's book, Braving It, A Father, a Daughter, and an Unforgettable Journey into the Alaskan Wild. You can also follow Aiden on her blog, Gritty Gal. The idea that losing yourself in a million acres of untouched wilderness could also be a way of finding yourself. That's part of the rationale for America's national parks. But setting aside that much land as a public trust has been and still is controversial. Terry Tempest Williams is a nature writer and an activist on the front lines of the battle to protect public lands, especially in her native Utah. No one writes more beautifully about the emotional and spiritual value of wild places. She's just come out with a new book about the national parks. This one's called The Hour of Land.
I was raised in the state of Utah, where 5 national parks and 7 national monuments are commonplace. We took them for granted. Zion, Bryce, Arches, Canyonlands, and Capitol Reef were in our backyard, the land where our families gathered and we roamed free. We hiked the Zion Narrows and escaped a flash flood. On that same trip, my brother and I camped against a red rock wall, and in the morning when we awoke, a boulder had fallen between us. In Capitol Reef, we picked peaches from orchards planted by Mormon pioneers. Natural Bridges had the darkest star-struck skies, the place where I almost died falling off a cliff with 136 stitches running down my forehead like a red river and a lifelong scar to prove it. We learned early on we live by wild mercy. But it was standing inside Timpanogos Cave, a national monument, as an 8-year-old girl that marked me. We hiked up the steep mountain trail that rises 1,000 feet from the valley floor. We were hiking with our church group from Salt Lake City, just an hour north. We reached the entrance of the cave and were ushered in by a park ranger. Immense stalactites and stalagmites hung down from the ceiling and rose up from the floor, declaring themselves teeth. We were inside the gaping mouth of an animal. But it was the great heart of Timpanogos Cave that captured my attention. When everyone else left the charismatic form, I stayed. I needed more time to be closer to it. I wanted to touch the heart, run the palms of my hands on its side, believing that if I did, I could better understand my own heart, which was invisible to me. Suddenly, I heard the heavy door slam and darkness clamp down. The group left without me. I was forgotten, alone, locked inside the cave. I waved my hand in front of my face. Nothing. All I could hear was the sound of water dripping and the beating heart of the mountain. I don't know how long I stood inside Timpanoga's cave before our church leader realized I was missing, but it was long enough to have experienced how fear moves out of panic toward wonder. Inside the cave, I knew I would be found. What I didn't know was what would find me, the spirit of Timpanoga's. To this day, my spiritual life is found inside the heart of the wild. I do not fear it, I court it. When I'm away, I anticipate my return, needing to touch stone, rock, water, the trunks of trees, the sway of grasses, the barbs of a feather, the fur left behind by a shedding bison.
Terry Tempest Williams, reading from her new book, The Hour of Land. Steve Paulson recently sat down with her to talk about the lasting value of our national parks.
Terry, have the national parks always been part of your life? I mean, is this something that's part of the family DNA?
It is part of our family DNA, and I would tell you that my first memory is in a national park, Grand Teton National Park, to be specific. What I remember is kneeling before Hidden Falls, the spray of the water on my face, with my mother on one side and my grandmother on the other, and I was kneeling down with cupped hands drinking that cold mountain water. I'll never forget that. It's my first memory, and I think to this day, I still search for that feeling of home, refreshment, renewal.
Now, the national parks have a complicated legacy. I mean, they are more popular than ever, and some of them are practically overrun by visitors. And we should point out that not all national parks are wonders of nature. Gettysburg is now a national military park, and this is a place not only to commemorate the dead, but it's also... it's become a contested place where different versions of the Civil War get played out. I mean, you write about your guide who was actively on the side of the Confederacy. I mean, she thought the wrong side won the war.
And I have to tell you, Stephen, my ignorance as a Westerner, or my own ignorance, I didn't realize how strong her point of view was until about halfway through. And I thought, aha, so this is why we are focusing on Pickett's Charge, where a tremendous amount of men were killed because Robert E. Lee would not give up his plans. And you see the fall of the South in that moment. It wasn't until I realized, oh, my God, her saddle is the Confederate flag, the blanket that is supporting her saddle, that I realized we were literally in the point of view of the South. It was fascinating.
And again, I mean, she works for the National Park Service. I mean, this is not just some outsider you're talking about.
Well, she's a licensed guide, which, you know, is hard won. But this is the history of our national parks, of our battlefields, of our seashores. One story is not sufficient. There are many stories to be told in each of our national parks.
You write about touching the essence of a place. As a writer, how do you do that?
You know, I think it's always an attempt. And one of the things that struck me about each national park that I visited was that there was always a tender point. There was a moment where I thought, ah, here, this is where the heart beats for me in this particular place. I remember the vastness of Big Bend National Park. And I was so stunned for so many reasons. I thought, this is what I remember in southern Utah as a child. And I realized how much fragmentation has occurred because of the oil and gas development outside Arches and Canyonlands. And in Big Bend, there was a moment where we were at the very end of the canyon in Santa Elena. And honestly, If I ever disappear, I will be there. It was so magnificent. It was so still. It was so quiet. The shadows and light. The sound of rushing water. Borderlands. Sacred lands.
One thing I was curious about in that chapter on Big Band, you refer to various notebooks, your turquoise notebook, your green notebook, your orange notebook. Do you actually have all these different color notebooks?
I do. I had this set of rainbow notebooks. You know, they were artist notebooks, blank notebooks. And I just thought, you know, we're going to be there for 14 days. I had 14 notebooks. So would you believe me if I told you I filled a notebook a day? That's how passionate I was about Big Bend. Honestly, it's my favorite national park right now, and I just reveled in every single day of it.
Do you carry around notebooks as you're out there hiking?
I always have a journal with me, and, you know, it's probably an illness, a sickness, but I can't take something in if I can't take my notes. It's like an artist's sketchbook. And of course, when I'm walking, I'm present. And when I'm sitting, I'm listening. But then there comes a point where I just have to write to qualify, to quantify what it is that I'm seeing, feeling, experiencing. And I realized, Steve, in Big Bend, the desert is not a void, but my unknowing. And I think it's that humility before landscape, so immense, so large, timeless, that we experience awe, humility, wonder.
I love that phrase of the unknowing. What do you mean by that?
It's just, you know, I think as human beings, we think we're the center of the universe as a species, and we're not. I just think, you know, when you go into places like Big Bend or Grand Teton or, my goodness, Gates of the Arctic in Alaska, it's so clear that we are one species among many, and I'm stunned.
It's so interesting to hear you say that Big Bend is now currently your favorite national park. I mean, because my sense is that the landscapes you are most drawn to are the barren ones, and especially the desert. Is that true?
I think that is true. I love erosional landscapes. I love being able to see out. I love the bare-boned architecture of the Chisos Mountains or buttes and mesas in Utah. And I love these landscapes of little water that Mary Austin talks about, where everything is brought to its essence. And I think including us, I love that. I get a little nervous when I'm in places with too much green, I must admit.
You know, for a lot of people, you know, the desert's a scary place. It's so forbidding.
It is a scary place.
So you get scared there too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a harrowing place. But, you know, you're brought down to your knees, and I think that's healthy. Like I said, I get nervous if there's too many trees and I can't see out.
There's another line in this book that just blew me away. Wilderness is the source of what we can imagine and what we cannot, the taproot of consciousness. It will survive us. Can you explicate that?
We're a part of something so much larger. You know, I remember when my brother Steve was dying of cancer, and I remember walking in one morning and I said, "Steve, how are you doing?" And he said, "You know, I'm great if I don't start thinking that I'm someone special." And I think it's that, again, that humility that we're part of something so much larger than ourselves. And that, to me, is the taproot of consciousness. And whether we're facing our own death consciously, whether we're facing an immense mountain, to me, we touch the ineffable. It's that vibrating energy. It's the stuff of mirage. It's heat waves. It's ghosts rising from the fields of Gettysburg. It's what our national parks hold for us. It's our bedrock. It's what makes us Americans. And I know that's not politically correct to say, you know, but as citizens of this country that I believe is in such a crisis, spending the last 5 years looking at our histories, both political, natural, historical, really allowed me to fall in love with what is beautiful about this country. And what is beautiful is not necessarily all good, but it's what we are learning. It's how we're evolving to a deeper state of mind of the open space of democracy.
Terry Tempest Williams, talking with Steve Paulson. She's the author of Refuge and a new book on national parks called The Hour of Land. Steve and I actually met Terry last year when we did a live show for member station KUER in Salt Lake City. The way she talked about that Utah desert, we knew we had to go back. This spring, we took our 18-year-old son to visit the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. I'd actually never seen anything like it. Had you?
You know, I visited some of Utah's national parks when I was a kid, Zion and Arches. But the thing that really surprised me was the scale of this place.
I mean, it was huge.
It was huge, actually bigger than Zion and Bryce and the Grand Canyon combined. And also, there weren't many people there. I mean, unlike those national parks, which are kind of crawling with people. I mean, this place was really desolate.
There was this one day when we went out with a guide, this guy named Nate Wagoner. He's the co-owner of a local outfitters that he founded, Escalante Outfitters. And remember, we would stand on these plateaus and look out, and I would just think, that's a lot of rock. Yeah, and then Nate showed us how to look at it.
Well, I mean, he kind of reads the landscape as he walks along it. And I got this incredible sense of deep time. I mean, he talked about, you know, all the dinosaurs that had lived around here. And you can go back even further than that to when the North American continent looked totally different.
So here's us standing by the side of Highway 12 at the entrance to Hole in the Rock Road. And you have to picture Nate gesturing across this, you know, horizon to horizon, this huge expanse.
About 92 million years ago, there was a gigantic inland sea that divided the continent in half. All of the middle of the country was completely submerged in a shallow inland sea. And we were two continents, is kind of how paleontologists look at it. We would be on Laramidia on this side, and we'd be on the shoreline of Laramidia. And it was like a gigantic island that had mountains on it and rivers flowing down into this inward seaway.
It's kind of crazy considering this is one of the driest places I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Well, you know, 92 million years gives you a lot of room to play, right? Trust me, it's been a lot of different things over geologic time. And wrapping our minds around geologic time is one of those concepts that, you know, people struggle with, even great geologists. And if you're not struggling with it, you're not thinking about it hard enough. It's huge. But we're on the Colorado Plateau, so it's all in order as we go down time, as we go deeper, as we just drive down Highway 12, we will be driving back 100 million years and by the time we get down to the Escalante River in about 15 minutes. So it's all stacked right there, and it's just there to look at and see and marvel at. The Kaparowitz was...
We're looking at a vast stretch of desert with shrubs and rocks and, in the distance, some of the most remote mountains in the lower 48 states. But the point is, it didn't always look this way.
It is the sea floor's deposit. As you look at it, it's the fossilized remnants of a sea. And it is chock full of wonderful dinosaur discoveries because we are on the shoreline. And these guys are all grazing and hanging out, and we're finding, you know, Triceratops creatures in this section, gigantic crocodiles the size of school buses. And then in the sea, we find sea turtles, we find pliosaurs, paddled reptiles, mosasaurs, which are like the orca of the ancient sea. Fantastic stuff, full of dinosaurs that we're just beginning to find. The largest skull found on planet Earth came from the Kaparowitz Plateau.
Really? What's the skull?
It was a giant Triceratops kind of creature, Triceratops.
Just a few miles down Highway 12, we pull off to the side of the road, and Nate points out a rather ordinary-looking slab of sandstone. And there they are, dinosaur footprints.
Oh, my gosh.
Three-toed critter walked over 190 million years ago.
And the footprints, I have to say, are not very big.
What kind of creature do
we know?
Well,
this is probably representative of most of the dinosaurs that were on the planet Earth. They weren't T-Rexes running around all over the place, but most of them are about the size of a chicken. That irony never escapes me whenever I look at my chickens running around in my backyard either.
I mean, there's sort of a bird-like quality, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And what happened was is this guy was cruising around in probably kind of a little bit of a wetter area in this sand field, and his footprints went into the sand, and then something fell on top of it, a little organic matter, a harder material, and then we happened to be here at the exact right time where it eroded just this small layer of sandstone away. I mean, these won't be here much longer.
That is amazing.
Yeah, that is totally cool. Oops,
we're going to keep driving down the road, right?
Yeah. I've looked all over here, and I can't find any more.
So just to go back to your own story a little bit, what made you want to come to here, to this landscape? What is it about this landscape that attracts you so much?
Oh, the desert when I was young just definitely put its teeth in me and just kind of wouldn't let go. And I think it was that idea of wilderness, where wilderness doesn't have to be comfortable. And in its beauty in itself is in its harshness. When you go out there, you can get lost in this country and it doesn't care about you. Its grandeur just kind of can't but take root and take a hold of you.
And why Escalante? Why this particular
Why
place?
Escalante? I mean, Escalante is it's kind of like a little outlaw community, and in so many ways, it is even more untouched than all those other spots, you know? When we were young, we spent a lot of time in Moab and those places, and they became civilized. And Escalante was that last bastion of wildness that's out here. And so I think that was the idea. I mean, I came out here because there was nobody else out here. And then I came out here and then I became a fishing guide. And there definitely wasn't a fishing guide out here, you know? And I'd always worked for other people. And this was my time to kind of start my own deal. And I think that also has a lot to do with the West, you know, like going out and becoming yourself, your own person. And I always thought I would continue a little bit further north, but nah, I never got any further north than this.
Nate's very aware that lots of people have come and gone on this land for centuries. So he keeps exploring around here, and every so often he stumbles on remnants of a lost civilization. Some years back, he discovered a series of caves filled with ancient petroglyphs. So he took us to see some of them, down an old river wash, past the few desert shrubs that have managed to eke out a living here.
What's this little spiky thing? Looks like
that's a, it's called black rush. It's in the rose family.
Okay. We hiked down to the top of a canyon and three caves filled with rock art that's way older than even the nearby pictographs of the Anasazi.
The petroglyphs that are in these caves are left by hunter and gatherer people. And they were pretty much doing what people did the majority of the existence in North America. They followed big herds, and they never, ever even thought about planting something in the ground.
So what time period are we talking about here?
So probably maybe 200-300 BC. So we're in a tight bottleneck of a short canyon, and then right below us off this point here is about a 300-foot drop to the canyon floor. So
and as radio producers, there's something else we are thrilled to discover.
Now, the archaics were very particular about acoustics, so you have a cathedral effect. So if I go, woo, I get it over there too. And so they were very, very interesting people. We don't know anything about them. They have very little remains. Primarily what we find are pictographs that are left behind.
Wow, I can see that from here.
Yeah, we're going to go look at this. You can see as you kind of let your eyes adjust, you begin to see different color pigments. Like, see these lines here? There's also the mouse man over here. he's mouse man. And yeah, I don't know, he looks like a rat figure with bird feet. Kind of a really, kind of very different. And he shows up twice on the wall here.
And we don't really have a clue why they did this, right?
No, not at all.
Do we know if they lived in this space, or was this more of a ritualistic space?
I think people primarily think that they did not live in these spaces. These were places that kind of were come to at certain times and used and then left. I mean, these people stayed on the move. They had to follow animals because they're, you know, they moved with the seasons.
Do you sometimes try to put yourself in the minds of those people or sort of imagine what it would have been like to be alive then?
Yeah. All the time. I think that would be a pretty interesting thing. I also like to think that it wouldn't be a whole lot different. When these people were standing in this rock wall, this place looked just like it does right now, you know? But I do like to kind of think about that. The things that I always think make a better mind, you know, traveling long distances, interactions with other peoples.
That's what these archaics were doing. They were moving. They were hunting. They were coming across other people. I mean, that is an amazing thing to think about, what kind of mind that creates in a person. And when you're traveling through a place like this, the internal landscape is definitely affected by the external landscape here.
We weren't in this barren desert landscape for very long, but long enough to see why people keep coming back, or like Nate, simply never leave.
Being in a place like this, you start out in small dosages and you're like, yeah, I want to be out there. I want to go for a hike today. And then you get this like immunity to it. And you're like, no, I got to stay out for 3 days. No, I got to stay out for 4 days. No, I'm going to go out for 2 weeks. I'm going to go out for 3 weeks. I'm going to do 3 months, you know, and it takes sometimes a little bit longer. You have to stay out a little bit longer to get that feeling back. Sometimes that scares me. And sometimes it just kind of, it's fascinating to me, but you know, it really drives you to want to be out there full time.
Nate Wagoner, on top of a canyon in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. Nate is a nature guide, and he's the co-owner of Escalante Outfitters. By the way, while Steve was recording that audio, I was taking pictures of the pictographs and dinosaur tracks. We'll post them on our Facebook page if you want to take a look. Coming up, the hidden and often contested history of wilderness. I'm Ann Strangehamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I am the child of a woman with deep brown skin and dark eyes, who married a fair-skinned man with blue-gray eyes. Yet as a little girl in California, I never knew race. Skin and eye color, hair color and texture, body height and shape varied greatly among relatives. Like the land, we appeared in many forms.
That's a passage from Laurette Savoy's collection of essays called Trace. It's part autobiography, environmental history, and nature writing. And unlike most people who write about nature, Laurette is less interested in the pretty parts, the pristine meadows and eroded canyons. She's more interested in how people have shaped and even fought over the land. History has not always been pretty. Native people, for instance, were forcibly removed to make way for our celebrated national parks. So the history of race and racism is embedded in some of our most iconic landscapes. Laurette grew up in California, and she told Raymond Tankekar that she didn't notice race until after her family left.
California was the place before race. And my father decided to move back to Washington, D.C., which was his familial home for generations, at the time of riots, when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, when Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. And so we returned east to a place that seemed to be filled with hate. And it was the first time that I understood that colored could mean something very different from sun and sky. And I learned that the first time at the age of 7 and 8, when I was spat upon and learned that I could be hated for the color of my skin.
And so at this point, I mean, did you see the natural world as kind of a refuge from that kind of hate?
Absolutely. I thought, or I came to understand, and I think this is one of the hardest lessons I learned as a young child, was that the landscape itself, whether it was a river named Potomac or a canyon called Grand, the landscape did not hate. It preceded hatred. Only people hated. And so I did seek solace and refuge in the land because I knew I wouldn't be judged or spat upon or hated.
You bring a lot to the table in these essays. I mean, you're a nature writer and an environmental scholar. You're also a person of color, and we don't really usually hear that perspective in nature writing. What changes about how we think about nature when we consider the sad legacy of race in America?
I think many people think of nature writing as going out into nature, experiencing it in solitude. But I think it's very important to think of environment and nature in a larger sense. Take, for example, the idea of wilderness. Wilderness as an idea and as preserved land never existed apart from human experience. And if you consider Yellowstone, which is the first national park established in 1872 by Congress, what many people don't realize is that that land lay within ancestral homelands of Shoshone, Bannock, Crow, and what were regarded as sheep-eater tribal peoples. The U.S. Army would have to remove these peoples to reservations. So it's important to remember that even wildernesses had a long indigenous presence.
In another chapter of the book, you write about place names, names like Sequoia, Shenandoah, Cheyenne, Mojave, Yosemite. And a lot of these names come from Native traditions. So what changes when you kind of unearth those histories?
What's really critical to understand is that far from innocent, naming and mapping were essential to the projects of possessing and creating a new world. And so half of the United States, or more than half of the United States names, originated in some form from Native languages. But the words and the phrases were often reshaped by European colonists and their descendants with little sense of the original use and context. A really good case in point is the name Wyoming. It originally came from a valley in northeastern Pennsylvania that was named the Wyoming Valley by the Lenape people there. And it meant either at the Big Flat or the Great Meadows. But in 1778, during the American Revolution, there was a massacre, a killing of 300 settlers by British and their allies who were Tories as well as Iroquois. And because of that massacre, in honoring the people who had been killed, a poem was written in the early 1800s that was called Gertrude of Wyoming, and that poem became extraordinarily popular. And then within a few decades, the name Wyoming was applied to different places from the East Coast westward, and it won out because of the sound. It sounded beautiful.
Well, another thing you point out in the book is that there's also a long history of names that involve slurs, especially those referring to African Americans. And I was, frankly, I was amazed to discover that, you know, many of these derogatory names still exist.
Unfortunately, they do. There were, before 1963, about 200 American place names that had, and forgive me for saying this horrible word, but nigger as part of the word. And if I may say a few, they included Dead Nigger Creek, Dead Nigger Hill, Nigger Gulch, Nigger Prairie, on and on. And for decades, the NAACP and other groups petitioned an organization within the federal government that's called the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, which is the organization and government that officially gives place names and monitors place names. And so the board was petitioned again and again, and finally in 1963, it changed nigger to negro in most of the cases, but not everywhere. Some of the original uses still linger. And other slur names remain as well, or they've only recently been changed. Near Pocatello, Idaho, is a mountain that once was called Chinks Peak. And in 2001, it was named Chinese Peak. But many are still, as you noted, official names on the land. There's Picaninny Buttes in California, There's Darkey Springs in Tennessee. There's Wetback Tank in New Mexico. There's Wap Draw in Wyoming. There's Dead Injun Creek in Oregon. There's Sambo Creek in many states. And they go on and on.
I guess I'm wondering, for you, are you able to still appreciate the natural beauty of a landscape if it has one of these awful names?
Oh, of course. The place is not the name. And if you understand the history of naming as a history of overlay, the name is not the place, but they are overlays that tell us much about the history of possession, of conquest, of relabeling. And for me, the whole journey across the country, discovering these unspoken histories, has been a way of finding home. And we're marked by residues of the country's still unfolding history and residues that include silence and displacement that cross generations.
Laurette Savoy teaches environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College. She was talking with Raymond Tangekar about her book, Trace. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. When Robert Moore graduated from college, he decided to take 6 months off to fulfill a dream. He sublet his apartment, sold everything he owned, said goodbye to his friends, and set off to hike the full length of the Appalachian Trail, 2,000 miles from Georgia to Maine. It took him 5 months, during which time it rained nearly every day. So instead of sweeping mountain vistas, he got mud, not what he had signed up for.
You know, we think of hiking as an aesthetic experience, and we often think of it in terms of vistas and landscapes. And so when you don't have it, it feels odd. You think, what's the point? Why am I walking if I can't see a view?
So maybe because he spent a lot of time looking down at the trail, Robert started thinking about paths in general. Since then, he's traveled all over the world exploring animal, insect, and fossil trails. Ancient roads, neural networks, the tracks of stars. His new book is called On Trails, An Exploration, and it begins with the question most hikers have wondered at some point, who built this thing?
The moment you really start thinking about it is when the trail goes wrong. It's when something a little bit illogical would happen, that you would get intensely frustrated and you would think, who built this? And
what
why?
Do you mean?
Why
what?
Did they put this here? A hiking trail is designed to be sustainable. So it has to shed water in certain ways. It has to avoid certain places. So it will sometimes go a place where you as a hiker don't want to go, but the trail builder needs you to go there. And, you know, hikers get very, very frustrated by this because hikers, especially through hikers, want to get where they want to go as quickly as possible. They want to follow the path of least resistance. And so that's one of the interesting things about the task of building hiking trails is that you have to convince people to go where they don't necessarily want to go. And oftentimes hikers won't do it. They'll take a shortcut and they'll create what are called desire lines, which cut across the trail.
I love that term, desire lines. That was the point when you first brought it up in the book where I thought, oh, that's such a beautiful metaphor. It made me wonder, you know, like, what's the desire line in my life? And am I following it?
Yeah, it's true. It has a really strong metaphorical resonance for people because we are born
into the world, I think, with various paths laid out for us. And one of the questions is, it's really the deep question of wisdom, is do you follow these paths that are laid out for you, or do you start making your own path? And the one of the things I love about the metaphor of the trail is that it is so applicable, because most people have walked on trails. Everybody has walked on some kind of trail, whether it's in an urban environment or in the woods. So you know instinctively it's much easier to walk on a trail, right? It's much harder to strike off into the weeds and the brambles. And so that is something that I thought about constantly while I was hiking the Appalachian Trail, is by following this path that was laid out for me, am I missing something? Or is this actually the best path from Georgia to Maine?
Well, that's interesting, because in our culture, I think we tend to glorify the trail blazers rather than the trail followers. As you explored the metaphor, did you come to think differently?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a very American way of thinking, right? And if you go back and you read, for example, Thoreau is appalled by the idea of following a trail. He believes everyone should be a trailblazer in life. And of course, Emerson writing about self-reliance, there's a long tradition in America of believing that following a trail is kind of shameful. It's kind of cowardly. But actually, when you look into it, following a trail is also a very original act, because every person who follows the trail edits the trail a little bit as they're following it. That's what I find so beautiful about them. It's such a beautiful idea that we are, as a collective body, we are creating this thing together, which takes us all where we need to go.
You did so much research, you know, exploring so many different kinds of trails, and there are things that I love knowing, having read the book. For instance, the oldest trails in the world are 565 million years old. They were created by, some of the earliest animals? They're fossilized now.
That's right. Ediacara, yeah.
Ediacara. And they're in Newfoundland? They were discovered only recently, right?
Yeah, so they were discovered by an Oxford researcher named Alex Liu, who was just wandering along the seashore there in a place called Mistaken Point. He was looking for Ediacara biota fossils, which are, as far as we know, the earliest form of animal life. They're Precambrian animals, so they don't look like anything that you would ever even imagine as an animal. They don't even look like trilobites. They look, to my eye, like underwater plants. But of course, plants had not even evolved at that point. This is how far back we're going. And so Alex Liu found these little traces, and he realized that what he had was the oldest trail on Earth. He'd found the oldest record of an animal intentionally moving, and it was just sort of scrunching along. You can see how painstaking and difficult it was when you see these fossils, as I have, just inch by inch moving through the sand. And that little movement in some ways led to the incredible diverse array of movement you see on Earth now.
What are the most complex trails you uncovered?
Probably ant trails. Because they're made of pheromones, they're not impressed into the Earth. They evaporate very quickly, which means that they can change very quickly. And what that allows ants to do is to create these networks of incredible efficiency. So they can solve problems that we even have trouble solving, and people will actually study ants to learn how to better route packages through a shipping network, or how to better route information through the internet.
Really?
It's true. It's amazing, because they're very simple animals, and yet collectively they're incredibly smart. And in a certain sense, that collective intelligence resides in their trails. It's the very structure and makeup of their trails that makes them so smart.
What's so amazing about their trails?
Well, for example, fire ants, which E.O. Wilson has famously studied, they can tell each other not just where food is, but how much food is there by the strength of their trail. And then as the food begins to diminish, the trail will begin to dissipate as well. So you have this ever-updating map of where all the food is, and it's mesmerizing. Because you think, how could they have, with no central coordination, they're managing to do all of this. It's incredible.
You also remind me, you mentioned E.O. Wilson. There was some anecdote you wrote about that he used to, almost as an entomologist party trick, he used to write his name in ants?
That's right, yeah. He isolated the trail pheromone, and he would write his name on the ground or on a piece of paper, and the ants would line up and spell out his name, and it would just amaze his visitors, yeah.
things entomologists do for fun. There's another like little factoid you mentioned that just fascinates me. Elephants turn out to be amazing virtuoso trail makers.
Yeah, incredible. Probably unparalleled because of their size and their intelligence and the incredible power of their sensory organs. They will find paths that we end up building into our roads and our highways. I remember hiking in Tanzania years ago and following elephant trails and just marveling at them, thinking, how do they always find the shallowest crossing across a river? How do they always find the lowest pass through the mountains? You imagine them almost having a kind of telepathy or a God's eye view of the landscape.
They also seem to sort of have evolved to walk trails. Their feet are incredibly light.
They're incredibly soft, they're incredibly cushioned, and they're very sensitive. They're incredibly sensitive to the point that their feet are almost like stethoscopes. They can actually feel vibrations through the ground and sense rainstorms many, many miles away. There's a little anecdote which describes a group of three rangers who were sleeping, had accidentally laid down a tarp in the middle of an elephant trail and woke up in the morning and realized that there was an elephant footprint in between where they were lying down. An elephant had actually walked right over them, and they hadn't even known it because that's how quiet they are.
Wow. Have you ever been in a pathless wilderness, tried hiking without a trail?
I have, yeah. I've quite a few times I found myself for certain stretches, but by far the most memorable was in Newfoundland, a place called the North Rim Traverse around Western Brook Pond, which is designated as a pathless wilderness. They will never build a trail there. And you actually have to pass a navigation test before you can go in. It's a little bit daunting. You have to pass this map and compass test, and then they give you a little tracking device, which will locate your hopefully still living body if you stop moving. And I went there by myself. I had no cell phone. I had no GPS, just a map and compass. I really wanted to test myself. And it was, to be honest, it was kind of horrifying. I felt very, very uneasy from the first moment I started out because I realized how accustomed I had become to following a trail. And there were these trees called tuckamore, which are elfinwood trees. They're very short and very sturdy. They can be 100 years old and only reach as high as your waist because the wind has stunted their growth. And so you had to fight your way through these trees. And for 3 days, I just fought and fought my way across this landscape. I got completely lost. I was miles off track. And then on the last day, I found my way back to the trail. There was a big cairn, a big stone cairn marking where the trail was. And I felt this flood of relief just to be back on a trail. And that was, I think, when I really realized the value of a trail.
Robert Moore talking about his new book called On Trails, An Exploration. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Paulson put this hour together with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and John Merfeld. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.